Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on the show, and what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. The opioid crisis has hit our region hard, as it has the entire country. For decades now, medical researchers have been studying opioids and addiction, trying to figure out how to help people. But there's often a gap in understanding between the people who do this research and those who can actually implement it, like lawmakers and their staff, ER doctors and nurses, and social workers. Leading the effort to connect all of these groups together through research is Dr. David Cragg. He's a surgical oncologist and the SD Ireland Professor of Surgical Oncology at the Larner College of Medicine at UVM. He's working to build a database of opioid-related research. Dr. Cragg, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Well, thank you, Michaela.
We are also joined today by medical student Ashley Sharma, who is assisting Dr. Cragg and this team in their work. Ashley, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Opioids, as I've said, have had a large impact on our region, and we want to hear from you today. How could this database of research be helpful in your work? What parts of opioid addiction remain a mystery to you? You can give us a call at 800-639-2211 or send an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Dr. Cragg, as I understand it, you have tried to explain this database, this massive database that you're building, to lots of different people, and you've figured out a pretty concise way to talk about it, your elevator pitch of sorts. And you've asked me if you can give that pitch today to start us off. So let's do it.
Well, it's a series of elevators. I guess the first thing is, why did I come to this in the first place? I'm a cancer surgeon, and I've dedicated 35 years to Vermonters to make better treatments for cancer patients. But my oldest son, a graduate of UVM, developed this awful disease that we call opioid use disorder. Now, doctors need fancy names for things, but, you know, it's straight up simple addiction. Like all of the many, many families hit by this disease, there are lots of ups and there's lots of downs. But he lost to the disease in May of 2020. And in addition to having friends die of COVID, when that was kicking, we had to bury our son. Doesn't matter whether it's cancer or it's opioid disease or whatever. When it hits a family, you do everything you can. And it can rip families apart, and it can make them stronger somehow. Our son should not have died. And for our family, we wanted to make sure that this doesn't happen to any other family. So I did what I know how to do, understand the details, understand the problem, but on my own terms, and not take anyone's word for it. Start from scratch. If everyone knew so much, the problem would have already been solved. Common sense stuff. But everyone knows this is far from solved. And that's why I'm here today, to explain the problem and to help provide a solution. And it begins with understanding that opioid disease is just that. It's a disease. And diseases get studied by doctors and researchers, and they publish their findings. How much information is there out there published? All right, I hope you're sitting down. There's 43,000 published manuscripts.
What? That is a lot. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh.
All right. So a busy doctor, you know, maybe they'll read 10, maybe 100 a year. Let's give them 100. Do the arithmetic. It's not even possible to come close. And what we've done is to figure out a way to condense that information so much more of it can be used. So how did we make this knowledge base? A manuscript publishes observations. What do the researchers or doctors see? And we grab these observations, like netting a fish. And we take all those observations from hundreds of manuscripts and we line them up. Now, suddenly, we see a lot of observations all at once, thousands of them. Imagine seeing all at once what hundreds of doctors and researchers have seen. In its simplest terms, this project is a knowledge broker for opioid disease. So how does this work in Vermont? How well does it work? So my team went out in Vermont to find out. They tested this knowledge base here in Vermont with policymakers. And we asked senators, representatives, and select board members. And the first thing we found was that policymakers were uncomfortable with the scientific literature.
Why uncomfortable? Was it using words that they didn't understand or they didn't know how to access it?
This is not their area. Most of them are not scientists. So yeah. It's scientific literature. If I was trying to read legal literature, I'd be pretty stressed and I would feel pretty uncomfortable. Or engineering literature, same mm-hmm. thing, right? But the team found and tested this out, that when using this opioid knowledge base, policymakers here in Vermont were 3.5 times higher to answer searches correctly than using any other source.
Hmm.
They also found that when the Vermont policymakers used this opioid knowledge base, they had increased levels of confidence and they had higher levels of satisfaction. So where are we now in Vermont and how to use this?
Wait, I have more questions.
Yeah.
I got more questions for you, Dr. Craig. Hold on 1 minute. So you had this enormous amount of research you were going through, 43,000 different articles. My first question is, how do you decide what's valid research? What's good research that you want people to be able to access? Can anything that has the keywords opioid and addiction go into this database?
That's the usual way people approach this, and it's not worked very well. So we took a very different approach. And I go back to the observations. If somebody observes something, shouldn't we have the advantage of being able to also observe that? All right. And if somebody else observed something similar, then we want to put those two observations together. It's like if somebody gives you direction somewhere and somebody says partway, the other person does the next direction. You want the whole thing.
So, Ashley, part of your job is going through all these mounds and mounds of research mm-hmm. and entering it into the database. How does your job work?
Yeah, so I joined a couple of months ago when this project was already pretty established. And like you said, my role is to go article by article, extracting the data, all the minuscule points, all the minuscule numbers here and there, the observations that are reported, and putting that into the database. And like was mentioned, it's very difficult to explain the database over the radio, but essentially what it is a very organized kind of flow chart of information that's broken down into different themes. So what my role is to put that extracted data into where I think it makes sense thematically so that we can pick up on patterns and derive those insights.
Mm. And this, Dr. Craig, is what you were showing to lawmakers and their staff to test how helpful this database is.
Yes.
Hmm. And I cut you off before. You had a little bit more to say about where we are in Vermont right now. And I want to hear it because I bet I'm going to have some questions on that too.
Good. Well, you know, opioid disease is very complex, you know, but so are other diseases, like breast cancer. And 30 years ago, you know, there really wasn't much of an organized approach to manage breast cancer. And patients, where were they? All right. They had to navigate through this complex system all at the same time of facing a life-threatening disease. And shortly after I arrived here, which is quite a while back, I started the breast center just to get everyone in the same room and hash it out. But back then, there was no such thing in the state of Vermont.
Hmm.
But now it's a great place to get treated because from the patient's perspective, it's very organized. But there's no such thing for opioid disease patients. It doesn't exist. So let's look at when a patient with opioid, what do they go through from their perspective, all right? A patient overdoses, and Michael LaChance's fire department, first responders rescue them. And they get to the ED, they're done, they drive away. In the emergency department, they finish resuscitating a patient. They'll try and refer them to treatment. But, you know, let's look at what really happens. The patient walks out and leaves. And the ED doctors are done. Now, since that patient was most likely resuscitated with Narcan, they're likely to leave the emergency department already starting to withdraw. And they probably don't have any money. So they're going to do some petty theft, which harms good people. And the police are called, and they bring the patient in. And they're going to book them and release them, or a concerned, you know, family member will pick them up. But the moment they leave, the police are done for now. So, you know, what if we get all these groups to work together, like the breast cancer center, and then, you know? But the cycle just goes on and on.
Hmm. So the connection, the place where breast cancer research is very different than where we are with opioid research, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah. Dr. Craig, before we go any farther, I want to acknowledge what you said about your son Peter's death. I'm so sorry for your loss. I've read stories about Peter, and he was a really talented musician, it sounds like, and somebody who was beloved for how kind and generous and compassionate he was. I'm wondering if you might be able to share what it's like to research opioid addiction while also holding this grief inside you. How does it interact? Does it, I don't know, in any way help with that grief, if anything can?
It, you know, when you're a family member and it's your child or your brother or your sister or your parents, you'll do anything to save their life. There's nothing a Vermont parent wouldn't do to save their child, right? But what happens is that once that's over, is that you can't address that anymore. It's done. But what you can do is to take whatever tools you have available and apply that so nobody else's children die. And so this is what we've done. We've taken what I know how to do and applied it. Some people do it by other means, but that's how we do it.
Yeah. Yeah. You're using your superpower for good. Ashley, you also worked with people with substance use disorder before beginning this work with Dr. Craig. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that work and how mm-hmm. it perhaps connects to what you do today.
Mm-hmm. It's actually what inspired me to join this project was the work that I was doing during my research gap year before medical school. So I was focused on researching family-centered interventions for adolescents struggling with substance use disorders in India specifically. And in India, I think because of the cultural aspects, there are a number of barriers that prevent proper intervention for adolescents with substance use disorders, namely the stigma that arises and the lack of family understanding of what addiction is, mm-hmm. considering it more of a moral failing and a choice almost, as opposed to an actual medical condition. So that's the research that I was working on and how we can deliver family-centered interventions and educate families as to the nature of addiction and help make them a protective factor to protect their children from substance use.
Hmm. You mentioned stigma. I'm wondering, Dr. Craig, if you think that the reasons why perhaps some of this work around opioid and addiction research and studying it as a collective body lags behind, say, breast cancer research, as you mentioned before, or cancer research as a whole, is in part because of that stigma that still exists around opioid use disorder.
When the AIDS epidemic hit, there was a lot of deaths before people got on board, and it was the AIDS activists that really kind of made the change. 35 years ago, breast cancer, we don't realize that today, it was a closet disease. People wouldn't even tell close family members that they had breast cancer, all right? But to bring it out in the open, women were activists, and they brought it out. And today, we have opioid disease with people dying. So who's going to help really motivate this? But I think the problem of the stigma is, you know, it sounds like it's a bad thing, and it's really... there aren't bad people thinking about it. Cliff Bauman, who's a colleague medical student of Ashley's, did an interview across Vermont. It's very interesting. And he talked to legislators, and he talked to police and law enforcement and also emergency doctors, and he asked them their opinions about what's called an opioid prevention site, which will be discussed in just a little bit.
Yes.
Now, what he found was the opinions of these groups were radically different. The doctors were overwhelmingly in favor of having a safe consumption site. The legislators, it was a complete opposite. Mm. They were not. Most were opposed. But the law enforcement, the police, 100% were opposed. Now, is that stigma? I don't think so. I think what happens is everybody's faced with their experiences. The doctors, they're faced with, you know, people arriving at their door very, very sick, and they have to do something. They don't want that. The legislators have to listen to their constituents, and they talk about dirty needles and, you know, people on the sidewalk. And the police, they have to go protect people. So everybody's got their own unique, correct perspective.
Hmm. And within this database, there is research that hopefully can tie some of those perspectives together so that people aren't just operating in their own silos.
There is an enormous amount of information on policymaking, on law enforcement, on medical treatments.
Well, let's go to the phones here. And if you have a question for our researchers here at the University of Vermont Medical Center, you can give us a call at 800-639-2211. We have Richard in Essex Junction on the line. Richard, go ahead.
Sure. So I'm a statistician at UVM, and I've worked with David for many, many years on some breast cancer studies years back. And a few years ago, I had a student that was interested, a psychology and statistics student who was interested in opioid use disorder because of a personal connection with a friend. Hmm. And so I started working with her on this project. She wound up contributing to the database and did a thesis, and the thesis was about stigma for opioid users, and that's something we're working on publishing. I'll just mention that in the project that was looking at, you know, testing the effectiveness of this database against other ways of gathering information, I spoke with lots of city councilors and members of the police commission while recruiting participants for the study. And something that wasn't captured in our study was the fact that so many of them mentioned that how important and how helpful it would be to have easy access to up-to-date and research-based information about opioid use disorder for, you know, making policy decisions and so forth. Hmm. So just thought I would mention that too.
Thank you, Richard. So that need is there. People are asking for this work, Dr. Craig.
That's right.
We have a call now from Jackson in Braintree. Jackson, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Michaela. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is such a great topic and so timely. I wanted to ask if the researchers have made use of artificial intelligence in their efforts to distill down this massive body of research.
Thank you, Jackson, for the question. Actually, I might start with you. Has AI play a factor in any of the work that you're doing with this database?
As of yet, no. It's all very, our role is to do the data extraction and then figure out where it goes into the larger scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
And AI, as we know, it's very effective. It's very efficient. However, it does miss out on those nuances that only humans understand and only judgments that humans can make at the end of the day.
Mm.
So no, this is all very us, very brute force.
There's a person behind every
yes.
bit of this database mm-hmm. right now. Dr. Craig, any plans to incorporate AI into this work?
Oh, we already take heavy advantage of computer optimization,
yeah.
automation. And, you know, AI is really good at looking stuff up, mm-hmm. but it doesn't make judgments. And it can't connect the dots of information, you know, that haven't already been connected. And that's human imagination.
Hmm. Human imagination. Say more.
Well, you know, AI, we certainly tested it. We've tried to incorporate it. And when I work with Ashley and we're taking a manuscript and the observations, out. That's fine. AI can do that, kind of. But then you say, okay, I've got this observation, and I want to integrate that, put that next to other observations. Where does that belong? Where does that fit in? And AI is not there.
So there's currently more than 900 articles, I believe, entered into the database. How many are there total, again? Can you remind us?
More than 43,000.
Okay. So how long do you think it will take the team to enter all of those? Do you have a timeline for kind of quote-unquote finishing this project?
Well, the big task was setting up the computer tools to enable this. And then the second thing was to really is to develop this initial framework of information. And I know you'll say this later, that people can tap into this database and how to do that. But let's stay focused in on this here is that, integrating it is the key thing and presenting it. I'm not sure I answered your question, though.
Oh, that's all right. My question was about the timeline for finishing this project, if there is a finish line at all.
I think with five people working full time, we can have the entire world's literature scrubbed down within 3 years.
Wow. That's shorter than what I thought you were going to say. Well, actually, you have a lot of work ahead of you, I think. We just got an email from a listener named Chris who writes, is the approach to building this knowledge base and its query capabilities generalizable, that's a word I struggle with, by design, or is it mostly purpose-built? Dr. Craig?
It's absolutely by translatable. This started out by me frustrated with trying to keep up with the literature. I'd developed a new method to treat breast cancer some years ago that radically reduced the amount of surgery women needed. It was very successful. It's now used around the world, and millions of women have had this procedure done. And I wanted to keep track of all the literature. Hundreds of articles came. It just exploded. I couldn't do it. So I was motivated to develop some sort of a system. And that led ultimately to what we have today. And then I realized that, well, if I can read massive amounts of information, we can kind of turn it the other way and say, well, let's focus in on a topic. And then we develop tools for people to work together. So it's a group think.
Well, let's go back to the phones here. We have Peg calling in from Rutland. Excuse me. Peg, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Dr. Craig, number one, thank you so much. I had breast cancer in 1995, and I did participate in the sentinel node biopsy trial. That was also, I believe, when you were just getting the breast cancer center started. And at the time, I was taking a brief hiatus from a degree I had been working on part-time in information science at Simmons College. And so what I am hearing today resonates on so many levels, including the fact that I, too, have lost I have lost the offspring of friends, one of whom was very dear to me and was named Peter, to opioid death. So please, I mean, you must be some kind of miracle worker. Thank you so much.
Peg, it's so nice to hear from you. So thank you for helping out, back in 1995. I mean, if it wasn't for you and the other women who stepped up to the plate, it would not be of benefit to all these millions of women now. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Peg, for calling in. Ashley, what has reading so many of these studies taught you so far about opioid use disorder? What are your main takeaways?
First of all, it's taught me so much about the research project, just generally speaking, because I did my master's from Bloomberg, and research was one of the core focus areas. And we were taught a lot about the traditional ways of doing literature reviews, how to go through and analyze a large set of data. And then this is just so revolutionary, because what I understood was that my knowledge about the opioid use epidemic was a fraction of what it actually is. I didn't even have a solid understanding of what the problem was. And I think that's what's so concerning, and what I've learned about how we've tried to address the opioid epidemic thus far, is that we just don't have the complete picture. And my whole approach to solving problems is that it's threefold. First, you have to identify the problem. then you have to design an intervention to it, and then you administer that intervention. But the problem is, and that I've learned by extracting all of this information and reading all these articles day by day, is that we just don't have an understanding of the problem as a whole. We don't have an understanding of all the barriers that people face, all the factors that contribute to the opioid use epidemic, all the different perspectives and attitudes that different stakeholders have when it comes to this, and all the different factors that need to be considered when we do try to devise solutions to resolve this epidemic.
Let's go back to the phones here. We have Melanie calling in Charlotte. Melanie, go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I am wondering... two things. One, whether or not you are also including the courts in your work, because I know you mentioned law enforcement. And secondly, whether you are including or collaborating with some of the think tanks around the United States doing work on drug courts or courts and opioid addiction as well. For example, Urban Institute in Washington or Vera Institute in New York.
Thank you, Melanie. Yes, courts are often a place with high touch points for people who are experiencing opioid use disorder. Dr. Craig.
Thank you, Melanie. It's incredibly important, and there is an enormous amount of published information about the court process. It's quite a wealth of information to be used. The second question was about, or comment, was about think tanks, and we're starting out now, right? So you're hearing it today. As we get bigger and more information gets in, we hope to link up. And you'd be happy to facilitate that. We'll take it.
And Dr. Craig, for folks who are listening who are in perhaps a very different place than Burlington, which is where UVM is, of course, and maybe a small town, are there ways to use this database and kind of filter for the type of community that you live in, either the size of the place, its distance from a major metropolitan center, the economics of the town, and the type of research that might be particularly useful for that sort of place?
That's a fascinating and very valuable question. And what's remarkable is that people around the world are not that much different. People in Iran, we think of Iran, however we think of Iran, but they have a tremendous opioid addiction problem. But how they approach it is different. But they have their own set of problems. But it's very, very similar. And when we were diving into the literature on safe consumption sites or opioid prevention sites, which will again be talked about shortly, we have now scrubbed down almost all of the world's literature on this, and it's available in this database. And some of the concerns that were raised by legislators were, oh, well, we're Vermont, you know, we're different. We're a different size. It's not equivalent to Brooklyn or, you know, downtown Manhattan. But the literature is filled with places of similar size, multiple. So there's plenty of information out there that looks at that. But when we do look at it, not much different. People are people. The disease, you know, breast cancer is the same here as in Kentucky. Opioid use disorder is the same, all right? It's all across the land.
Yeah. Ashley, you said that you studied opioid use disorder among people in India. Do you agree with what Dr. Craig is saying, that, you know, the disease and the people who have it are the same everywhere?
Yeah. I mean, and I think that goes back to the core value of what addiction is fundamentally, which is a medical condition. Everyone has a brain. Everyone has the same reward, motivation, pathways in their brain. And it has the same physiological manifestation, and it has the same ramifications wherever you are, in that it affects all facets of your life, professional and personal. And that's irrespective of where you are.
Let's take one more call here. We have Kimberly in Montpelier. Kimberly, you're on the air. Go ahead and go ahead. Excuse me.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. Dr. Craig, thank you so much for just diving into something that's so important. My question is, given the prevalence of opiate addiction and really all addictions with personal trauma and intergenerational trauma, I'm just wondering if the system has some place for that. And then the second question would be, just the importance of, in terms of helping people to recover and to heal, and the benefit of trauma aware and trauma informed practices when we're dealing with clients that are in addiction, and like you said, the whole shame thing and a trauma-informed perspective is my passion project, and I'm just wondering what you thought about it.
Well, thanks, Kimberly. We'd love to have you participate. We're at about 1,000 articles, and already there's information on these very topics that you're referring to. At the very top of the first topic in the data knowledge base is medical treatment, or all kinds of treatments, and it includes some of the things that you're referring to, and taking advantage and understanding of the personal traumas and using these things to guide treatments and to facilitate better treatments.
Thank you, Kimberly. Dr. Craig, you said that you would love to have Kimberly participate. I'm hoping we can end there. What type of participation are you all looking for from the public, and how can people access this database right now?
We have a name for the to plug in. It's RefZoom. That's REF like reference and Zoom like ZOOM. RefZoom.com. And when you go there, you'll see on the, just scroll down a little bit, is a way to access this database. It doesn't cost anything. It's a free subscription to access this. And it's a couple of steps, and we'll get you on to access it. So we want people to use this and then to begin to comment and take advantage of it and get this out. Clearly, we've got a long ways to go, but it's already there. You want to learn about safe consumption sites, opioid overdose prevention centers? We've got almost every article in the world there. It's a phenomenal resource now. So this is why we're jumping out now, even though we have still a long ways to go. That's the most important thing. The second thing is that there will be people who really want to participate. Kimberly, if you want to take on that passion project, we would invite you into our inner sanctum with Ashley and the rest of us, pulling out observations.
Dr. David Craig from the University of Vermont Medical Center and the Larner School of Medicine, thank you for telling us about your son and about your work and your hopes you have for the future of research on opioid addiction. Thank you.
Well, Michaela, thank you for letting us communicate with people in Vermont. And Ashley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ashley Sharma is a medical student working with Dr. Craig on this process. And special thanks to my colleague Erica Heilman for connecting us with Dr. Craig and helping us produce today's show. You can find myriad attempts to treat opioid addiction and reduce deaths in our region. There are inpatient and outpatient treatment centers, special police and firefighter units, street teams of social workers, even Narcan vending machines. But right now, at least, you aren't able to find an overdose prevention center, also known as a safe injection or safe consumption site. There are two of these centers in New York City, one in Rhode Island, and about 40 across Canada, including in Montreal. At these sites, people can get sterile supplies and consume their own drugs under the supervision of trained staff. They have access to overdose reversal medication and medical and social services. Some see these centers as a way to reduce fatalities and treat people struggling with addiction with dignity. Others believe they're an inefficient use of limited resources or that they promote drug use. Burlington is about to start its own overdose prevention center, the first in Vermont. Here to tell us more about it is Teresa Vizita. She's Burlington's Special Assistant for Overdose Prevention Center Implementation. She was appointed by Burlington's mayor in December. And formerly, she was the executive director of Vermont Cares, an organization that provides harm reduction services for people with substance use disorder. Teresa, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you. And listeners, if you have questions about Burlington's planned overdose prevention center, you can call in and ask them right now at 800-639-2211. First, Teresa, I wonder if you have any thoughts about the conversation that we just had with Dr. David Craig about The enormous body of research that already exists about overdose prevention centers and the struggles that some municipalities can have in accessing that research. Are you all looking to places like New York and Montreal and Providence, Rhode Island, to figure out what to do here in Burlington?
Yes, absolutely we are. I think the great thing about research and all of what it provides for us is a bit of a roadmap. And although it can be very complex, it also is pretty straightforward. I had a really wonderful opportunity to meet with the folks in Rhode Island. I guess it was early February. Joined the mayor and Ingrid Jones, our special assistant on public safety, to a trip to Rhode Island, and went visited the Overdose Prevention Center there and was able to learn a lot from them about the trials and tribulations they went through getting their center open, but also how things are going for them as they had only opened a couple of weeks ago. Mm. There's lots of research out there, but I do believe that each community, we all have our own unique needs as well. So I'm looking forward to right-sizing all of what we've learned over the many, many decades that research has been out about overdose prevention centers and finding what works best here for our community.
Mm. And give us a little bit of the backstory here on this plan for the overdose prevention center. It's not something that just, you know, cropped up in Burlington and the residents got to decide it on its own, right?
No. I think back to way back when Sarah George had a safe injection committee that I was on. I believe that was back in like 2016.
State's attorney.
State's attorney Sarah George. Fast forward all of these years later, so much planning and thinking has been going on behind the scenes before this has happened. We were able to bring this to the legislature and, very similar to Rhode Island, have a state-sanctioned program, which means that our legislature, through Act 178, has sanctioned us to do this pilot here in Burlington. The really special part about that is it provides a certain amount of safety and immunity, not only for people who would use the program, but also for the staff and the volunteers. And, you know, it gives us the ability to try something that we've never tried here in Vermont. We have syringe service programs across the state. We know that harm reduction is an evidence-based strategy in reducing overdose death and also helping people to bridge to treatment and recovery and other types of services.
Who will run this center?
Well, there's a bit of a process that takes place through the Act 178 legislation. The city of Burlington will be granted the funds through the opioid settlement dollars that will kind of come down through the Vermont Department of Health. The Department of Health, through that same legislation, was required to create operating guidelines. I do know that the health department did also work with Rhode Island and On Point and learned lessons from them as they were putting together Vermont's operating guidelines. Those guidelines were made available September 15th of 2024. From those guidelines, the city now, our step is to identify a community partner who would be the organization operating the Overdose Prevention Center. They would be the city's partner. So the city will administer the grant, will work in collaboration with a community-based provider. The process for that, we began drafting what that would look like when I started my role in December, and that was posted live through a letter of intent process February 5th. That closed on February 26th, and the city, we created a review committee of different folks from cross sectors so that we'd have a good amount of different perspectives when we were reviewing the submissions. And so the committee met last week to sort of review and summarize what we all were taking from that and providing feedback to the candidates who did apply for this partnership with the city. From there, we will put together a proposal, which will be a kind of a phased proposal. The first phase will be really focused on planning and capacity building. In the operating guidelines of the that the health department put out, there's a really, actually, I believe, wonderful section on what's called a service assessment. It's very expansive list of individuals, communities, community partners, sectors, that would all, we'd want to get their input about what are your thoughts on, you know, what's going to work here in Burlington for an overdose prevention center. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly large, it's not considered a study, it's an assessment. So that's a big part of the planning, right? So we have, so what we design and establish here in Burlington is informed not only by the people who will be utilizing the program, but by also the partners who will want to make sure we have collaboration with, also our neighbors.
Is there a timeline for deciding and announcing who will be running the center?
We do imagine that based on, based on where we're at in the process, we would imagine an announcement being made either this week or early next week, probably, on who the identified partner will be, and we'll then together complete the proposal. The proposal is already being drafted, actually, and so we really felt it was important to identify who the city's partner was going to be, so that we could kind of complete the proposal, which will then go to our city council for a vote of approval, and then it will be submitted to the Vermont Health Department, and we will be able to begin this very crucial project.
Mm. Will that proposal also include a suggestion or a decision on where the center will be in the city?
That piece of the proposal will not, actually. The planning and capacity building of this project will actually help to inform the location. So that is kind of, if we look at it in different steps, I'd say step four, maybe. It's not one that we have already made. The provider is going to be really important to be a part of that conversation, of course. And no one wants to move without really intentional thought around a location. We want to utilize data. There's heat map data. There is overdose incident data. There's also, quite honestly, the need to talk to our community, to talk to our members of our community, and trying to find a location that meets the needs for people who would utilize the service, but also meets the needs of our broader community is really important to the city.
Mm. And it sounds like it might be too early to ask this, but do you have a sense or at least a hope of when this overdose prevention center might eventually open?
Well, you know, it would be great to have a magic wand and just be able to say, you know, right away, because we all know that this intervention is going to save lives. And it would be wonderful to just kind of snap our fingers and have it be done. But we know that that's actually not the reality. Ideally, in a perfect world, having a location determined and having the policies and procedures and all of the components in the operating guidelines completed towards the end of this year. Now that we're not talking doors open by any means, but there's a lot of steps that have to happen before you open up your doors and begin providing services. So all of that planning and capacity building, we anticipate starting as soon as we have our contract with the Department of Health and our service provider. Hard to give a date. Sorry.
No. Makes sense. I'm also wondering, you know, I know that there are other places that have studied the possibility of opening an overdose prevention center, but one never opened. I believe this happened in Pennsylvania, and there's other cities that have looked into it. However, some have opened, as I said earlier, in New York and Providence, Rhode Island, and there are many in Canada. I'm wondering, from your research into these overdose prevention sites, what takeaways have you learned that make you feel confident that this type of center will in fact one day open in Burlington, Vermont? So it sounds like there's a lot of hurdles ahead.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't consider it hurdles. I actually just think about it as necessary steps,
okay,
right? So let's less about hurdles and more just necessary process.
Yeah.
And the center is more than just a place for people to safely consume drugs, right? The center also is a community hub, a place where people will be able to access not only safer supplies and have the, you know, overdose reversal medication available right there on site, but other ancillary services that folks need. We know that people who use drugs are so much more than their use. They have many other intersecting complexities going on in their lives. We know that the data shows that many of the folks that would likely use a center like this here in Burlington are going to be people who may also be experiencing homelessness, may also be experiencing poverty and abuse and, you know, just isolation and just human suffering, quite honestly. So this center, I believe the will of our communities and the desire to support people who are in such great need, this center will provide that in addition to being able to be observed while you're using drugs means that you have someone there who's going to notice early signs of a potential overdose. In an overdose prevention center, we are likely seeing overdoses addressed well before a person even needs naloxone, well before they're even close to having a fatal overdose. When you can help people to stay alive and address those other basic human needs that actually, if you can't address their basic human needs first, it's really difficult to immediately jump to here's where you're going to get treatment. Sometimes we, as humans, we need some of those very basic needs to be addressed first. And I do believe that a center like this will be all of those things, right? It's going to take time to get there. But I believe that not only our community partners who I've been speaking to here and there since I started my role, but I've been in this field in harm reduction for over a decade. And I am 100% like sure that we've seen our state progressively move toward this since I've been in this field.
Teresa Vezina is Burlington's Special Assistant for Overdose Prevention Center Implementation and the former head of Vermont CARES. Teresa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.